You're listening to the Looseheads podcast. Join the movement.
Let's get people talking about mental health.
And together we will tackle the stigma. This is the Looseheads podcast.
Hi there, welcome to another week and another episode of the Looseheads podcast in association with Talking Rugby Union with me, Chris Hill. And thank you once again for popping in your headphones and giving us an hour or so of your time to listen to myself, Mark, Rob and Dave chat to our esteemed guests about all things rugby and, of course, tackling the stigmas in society and the stigma around mental health as well. And guys, welcome along as always. And I just wanted to briefly reflect on the first two podcasts we've done in 2021, if you don't mind, just to begin with, because we've spoken to Jamie Batty and Lima Sopawanga so far, and both have been brilliant in terms of talking to us about some of the funny stories they've been involved with in the game and their sort of individual careers as well. But what I think's hammered home and resonated with me so far is their individual stories and their individual journeys they've been on. And I think it's been really nice for us to be able to use a platform of the podcast to sort of tell their stories and share their journeys once again, hasn't it, guys?
Yeah, really, really enjoyed both podcasts. I said right after the podcast that we filmed or recorded with Lima that nobody can swear as cool as he does. And the use of the word dude. If I ever said the word dude, I'd get laughed at. And he says it, and it's just cool. He just oozes coolness. But yeah, it was great to hear his story. He was so open and honest, and you know that about the struggles that he faced when he first arrived in the UK, and going to seek external professional help. And it's really important to hear that from the players at the top of the game.
Yeah, couldn't agree more with you, Rob. And as I always say at the start of every podcast, it's well worth listening to both of those episodes if you can. And I think the rise in the story of our next guest certainly falls under that bracket as well. And we're delighted to say joining us on the podcast today is a leading Gallagher Premiership referee, Craig Maxwell-Keys. So Craig, thank you so much for jumping on the pod with us today. Before we press record, we mentioned sort of the break, which everyone seems to be going through at the top level of the game at the moment. So how's things with you? Are you enjoying the break, or is it a double-edged sword, as you said at the start?
Yeah, as I said, it's strange because we're welcoming the break because obviously we know what's coming up, which is a very big, thick block of Gallagher Premiership rugby. But obviously the community game's dying to get back to rugby, but obviously they can't. So yeah, we're very much coming from opposite ends of the spectrum. But no, welcome 2 weeks, 2 weeks off, partly because I've just redone the shed roof. So that was leaking. It's one of those jobs that even during lockdown one, we put off. But yeah, so spent the weekend redoing the shed roof. One of those jobs that no one else notices it, but you do. So it's, no one praises you for it, but it's quite satisfying knowing that the stuff you put in there is now not going to be sodden.
Well, interesting timing. You've decided to do it December, January time, Craig, rather than during that first lockdown where we had glorious weather.
It would have made a lot more sense. But as I said, it didn't seem like a very appealing job to want to do. It would have been a lot more sensible, as you say, because of the weather, as opposed to now where it's thoroughly miserable. But at least it got tested. It absolutely tipped it down last night, and so far, so good. So can't have done too bad a job.
That's very, very nice to put that, Craig. Very nice to put tested in the worst conditions possible. So, but obviously, during this strange time, Craig, as well, we've had rugby going on, which has been great for rugby fans and that community game as well, who are missing out. And for you as officials as well, Craig, how has that been? Because we had Carl Dixon on the podcast towards the end of last year, and he talked about how strange it has been with no fans there. But how's that experience been for you?
I didn't actually realise how weird it was until I was the reserve official at Twickenham. Because when you're refereeing, okay, yes, there's a difference, but you get so drawn into the decision-making, to talking to your fellow officials and the players, that it's actually a lot more limited times when you notice the lack of crowd. But when I was stood at the side of Twickenham as the reserve for the England-Georgia game, it took me 60 seconds to realise this is just awful. It's so quiet, so lacking in intensity. That was the first time it hit me as to, like, yeah, how desperately we need these spectators back. Because when you're absorbed in the game, as I say, yeah, there's limited chance to notice. But the second you're on the side watching, it was just, yeah, a damp squid ultimately.
Yeah, and I guess maybe the weather was more noticeable during the Premiership final than the crowd not being there last year.
Yeah, literally, of all the times for it to absolutely tip it down, would have tested my shed roof, as I said, that weather, because it was well and truly, truly miserable. Yeah, we train around the Twickenham pitch a lot, and even the Twickenham pitch was getting a bit boggy at the end of that game. It was, yeah, not ideal conditions, I suppose, that you want to see for a spectacle, but nonetheless, a final's a final. I think everyone was just grateful we managed to get there at all.
Yeah, yeah, we'll come on to that a little bit later as well, Craig, about the special occasion it was for you, despite and absolutely booking it down at Twickenham that day. And just to begin with, which we normally do on the podcast, is talk about Loose Heads and the tagline which the guys use, which is Tackle the Stigma, which is the hashtag that seems to be growing and growing every day on social media. Mark, I just want to bring you in on this to begin with, because we always talk about sort of the growth of Loose Heads and the partnerships which you guys have, which make Loose Heads what it is. And you always talk about kind of the backbone, which is team mental health in terms of mental health awareness. But I know you guys have struck up some partnership with Stonewall and the Rainbow Laces campaign. And it's all about inclusion and, like I say, eradicating stigmas, but around the LGBT plus community at the moment. So how important was it for you guys to show your support around the campaign, not only from a rugby perspective, but in society as well?
I've always felt, and since I was a young lad, that rugby is a game for all shapes and all sizes. And really, it was taking that phrase to the ultimate. I believe wholeheartedly that rugby is for everybody. I believe Loose Heads is for everybody. And it came out of a chat that Rob and Dave and I had about the Pride weekend coming into view. And I got on the phone with Stonewall. And we just positioned ourselves as saying, look, we have a certain reach. We're a duality between rugby union and mental health. Can we help you? And can we add one and make three or maybe five? And they were brilliant. They were absolutely brilliant. We offered to donate 10% of all the sales value to them. And we've made a couple of donations now to them. Yeah, it means a lot. I think working with like-minded partners, it doesn't feel like work. And that didn't feel like work. It just felt like the right thing to do. And we're delighted to support that.
Yeah, definitely, Mark. And I think what would have been nice for you as well, and maybe an extra sort of bonus for you guys, is when we were sort of watching the BT Sport coverage of the Rainbow Laces weekend around the Gallagher Premiership, that I think Craig Doyle, Ugo Monier and Lawrence Dahlia were doing the punditry, and they sort of were wearing some of the Loose Heads merchandise, and Craig touched on sort of the Rainbow Laces work which you guys do, which was really nice to see. And for you, Craig, just to bring you back in, obviously the Rainbow Laces campaign within rugby is all about inclusivity, and I guess that is highlighted by yourself. I know you came out publicly at the end of 2019, if that's correct. But before we kind of touch on that, why are campaigns like Rainbow Laces and organisations like Stonewall so important, not only within rugby, but spreading that message wider than our sport?
Yeah, I think whether it's the Rainbow Laces campaign or you've got Lift the Weight campaign, haven't you, that the RPA do, I think any campaign gives you that. I view them as like a catalyst or like that vehicle to drive a conversation. So if those campaigns can start conversations that otherwise wouldn't happen, then they're doing their job. And then I think that the challenge that we all face, I think Greg Bateman talked about it on your podcast a few weeks back, was what then happens to back it up? So what then, it's particularly at a community level. And that's where I think that Pride weekend and the Quinns Foundation that they've got, there's a lot of work to follow up on that conversation that's been started. So it's not just a flurry for one weekend. It's sustained, meaningful change that can then sustain itself at a community level over time. So, no, I think the campaigns are important, and as is the work that goes on behind the scenes. For example, as I say, the foundation at Quinns is doing, just to name one example.
And you talk about kind of starting the conversation, if you like, and I think that applies to both sort of the Rainbow Laces campaign, but also what Loose Heads do around mental health as well, because I know from personal experiences, I've talked about on the podcast before, that my brother's suffered from mental health, and the weight that was taken off his shoulders when he started the conversation, it just seemed to change him as a person. And I guess that applies with the Rainbow Laces campaign and stuff like that, Craig.
So you see the strap line, as I mentioned just a second ago, like Lift the Weight, and until you've actually spoken to someone about, whether it's me revealing my sexuality or even when I talked about my mental health battles for the first time, until you've been in that position and talked about it, you don't actually realise that that strap line is genuinely true. You feel so much taller just to be able to then, I suppose, live your life without, from my perspective, coming out without worrying about what lie or sort of mistruth did I tell this person to cover my tracks so they don't guess that I'm gay. And once you don't have to live that lie, it is so liberating. But yeah, as you say, those strap lines like Lift the Weight, sort of, you notice the difference and you don't realize how much effort it's been over the years that have preceded it to live the way you have, because it becomes normal. You spend years denying who you are, that becomes the new normal, that you forget what it should be like.
Yeah, we've spent we've spent quite a bit of time working with a fully inclusive club in the northwest of England called Village Spartans. And in my past, I've played rugby against them. And I've said it before and I'll say it again. When you go and you play Tyldesley on a very wet Saturday and you come away with a 3-3 draw, if you're lucky, and then you go in and you have your couple of pints of warm beer, it's really... I've never had a bad night out with the people at Village Spartans. And one of their members, a chap called Ben Dawson, who is the lead clinical psychologist in the Manchester Teaching Hospitals, has very willingly joined our mental health advisory panel. And that club is a beacon of excellence for me. And we've got a couple of relationships down in London with the Dodgers and what have you. But we fully believe that, like you say, when you raise those things, there's, for us, it's tackle the stigma, the lift the weight. It allows a conversation to be had. And that's all it does. But hopefully the more that conversation can be normal. And that's absolutely crucial, I think.
Definitely, Mark. And just in terms of that slogan that you mentioned there, Craig, in terms of lifting the weight and just maybe relating it to you doing a bit of research before the podcast and listening to some of the brilliant interviews you've done with Nick Heath around your sexuality. One of the stories which you said was, you know, you told your colleagues, and I think it was your local club, Lichfield, as well, about your sexuality by sending a message on WhatsApp and then switching your phone off before you're going on holiday early in the morning. So why did you feel the need to do that at the time? And was that just sort of going back to your point before about that weight was on your shoulders and this was kind of right, this is the moment where that weight hopefully will be lifted?
Yeah, I think once I told my family, and to be fair, those were the people I was, and close friends, those are the people I was most concerned about telling, right, which with hindsight is probably my biggest regret, my biggest embarrassment, because again, it's a double-edged sword there, because they're the very people that are all going to love you unconditionally, but they're the very people you don't want to lose. And sending ultimately what was a curveball their way, you ultimately don't know how they're going to react. But now, as I say, with hindsight, the fact that I ever doubted them is slightly embarrassing from my perspective. But once they were told and the reaction was, as it was always going to be, really positive, it then was the natural sort of next thing to do was to tell the people who I interact with on a daily basis. So my colleagues in people at Lichfield, because yeah, once you felt how good it was to tell the truth for once, then yeah, you didn't want to have those awkward moments in your daily life. You just wanted to get on with it and enjoy sort of living without that weight on your shoulders. I think as for why you did it, why via WhatsApp, I suppose because there was still that question of unknown, how would they react? So yeah, I could have told them in person with hindsight, but it was the easiest 21st century thing to do. And to be fair, it was quite nice turning the phone back on a few hours later in Greece and reading all the positive reactions. Yeah, had a good end story to it. It was the easiest thing for me to do at the time and the natural step, as I say, just to be able to crack on and not, as I say, not have those awkward moments. And again, it started a few conversations with a few other lads who know people in their family or their friendship group who have been for the same struggle. So actually it opened up a load of new conversations that I never expected to be having with them. Which again, just if I'd have known that earlier, then everything could have just been brought forward earlier. So it just shows the power of having that conversation.
And I guess that's probably why you touched on it there, Craig, why you did decide to turn your phone off and then switch it back on. I think you've mentioned it was 7 or 8 hours later. Was it because there was that part of your brain that was saying, well, I don't know what the reaction's going to be like by people? Was that just one of those hurdles that you look back on now and maybe think, well, I didn't even need to worry about that?
Yeah, I think when you're in sort of a defensive mode, which you are, because you don't want anything to change. You want the people who are close in your life, personal working life, you don't want that to change because it was going really well. So you almost do go into that defensive mode. And for me, that means you start seeing the negatives, or you focus on the negatives more than the alternatives. You almost assume that there's going to be a negative reaction just to prepare how you're going to deal with it yourself, which does other people a massive disservice. So it is almost, as you say, a preemptive defense mechanism. Again, completely unnecessary, but at that moment in time, it works. It gives you, I suppose, that extra bit of reassurance to be able to send the message in the first place.
We heard recently about Levi Davis opening up about his sexuality to his teammates at Ealing, and you know, he's quite worried at the time, and then the messages of support sort of started coming flooding through. Do you think that working in rugby and being in rugby or being in the rugby environment gave you the confidence to come out and, you know, with the inclusive nature that rugby does have, did that make it easier?
I think ultimately it probably played into it, because when you, even when I was going in, when I first got offered the contract in 2014, even looking in at that point as I was, you do see it, the perception of it, rightly or wrongly, but the perception still there is that it's sort of a macho elite environment. Now that is changing, clearly. And when you're on the inside, you realise that couldn't be further from the truth. It is an inclusive environment. So once I got through the door, got my feet under the table of that elite world, it soon became very apparent that I could tell these people and it would change nothing. It was a concern of mine outside looking in, because you don't know any better because you've not been a part of that environment from the inside. As soon as I was through the door, it wasn't an obstacle to me coming out. And yeah, there were certainly other people that I knew within the setup, as in at Twickenham, who were gay and were absolutely welcomed. You looked to them and they were really good at what they did, really happy with life and et cetera. So that certainly gave me an extra reassurance that I could do it and it was only going to be a positive.
It's a really wise comment, that. I love that.
Yeah, I agree with you, Mark, because I guess, Greg, as well, when you do talk about your experience, you do open up about your sexuality. Do you now feel maybe you could have, you've helped other people who might have it bottled up inside at the moment? Is that one of the reasons why you decided, I think it was 13 months ago now or 14 months ago now, you decided, right, I'm going to go public with it? Because as you said right at the start of the podcast, it can be a catalyst.
Yeah, so that was a strange one, because I always, when I came out initially, I was always like, right, we're going to talk about this, because I knew how much listening to other people's interviews, whether they were blogs or video or newspaper interviews, when I was in the closet, helped me. It was almost like a light at the end of the tunnel, like, you can get through this, you can ultimately come out, be honest, and look at all the examples of people being really successful at what they do. So I understood the power that being honest publicly could bring to people. But yeah, it took a long time for me coming out to doing that first interview. And it's ultimately because I ended up, I suppose I took the easy option, whereas I didn't actively look for opportunities to do it. But when one came my way, I would always take it. I just didn't expect it to take 3 years before someone actually went, hang on a second, do you want to talk about this on camera, which is what Nick did. And yeah, it shouldn't be difficult to have an honest conversation, but it often is for a whole host of reasons. I certainly enjoyed doing that interview. I enjoy talking about it. And if it helps others, however many or few, then look, that's a good thing. And again, like the Rainbow Laces campaign, if on the back of people listening to this podcast, it sparks those conversations that otherwise wouldn't happen, then well, no harm can come from that, can it? So if me talking about it and people listening to me constantly and they get fed up of it, but it starts conversations, then ultimately it's a good thing. So I'll keep talking, unfortunately.
And that's a key point, isn't it, to keep talking about these things. And just doing a bit of research as well, Craig, I was reading an interview with Nigel Owens, and he said that you two had a conversation about sort of your sexuality as well. And what an interesting thing he said as well is that he never, when he came out, he never wanted to be a role model. That was never the aim. And of course, that's not the aim, but it's happened. Do you maybe feel like, because you are in the public domain, you're one of the leading referees in the country, and now, as you quite rightly say, you're talking about your story more, you enjoy talking about your story more, it is getting more in the media, that you maybe see yourself as a role model now as well?
The notion of role models is, yes, a strange one, isn't it? Because I think a role model is what the individual wants it to be, that's viewing someone as a role model. So you can be a role model for your on-field rugby skill, or you could be a role model for how you carry yourself off the field. From my perspective, I'm just going to do me. So I'll be true to myself and just go about living my life, like privately and professionally, how I think it should be done and how I should be doing it. And if other people sort of look at that and class it as role model material, then I suppose ultimately that's a compliment to me. Certainly not my intention, but if that's how others look at me, then yeah, I'll take that as a compliment and happy days from my perspective. But it's me doing me naturally, not going out there with the intent of pinning myself up there as a role model.
Yeah, this might be a little bit of a difficult question for you to answer, Craig, but obviously Nigel Owen's top referee. I guess you would have aspired to follow in his footsteps anyway. But in terms of your journey, your story, did you maybe look at Nigel as a role model from that point of view at all? Or
no, clearly Nigel was the best parallel in terms of the world that I was a part of for 2 years when I wasn't out. So he remains the best example of, look, there's a professional in my line of work who's highly successful at what he does, who is very honest about who he is. So I suppose I was lucky in that sense. There's probably so many people in lines of work that don't have that direct role model to look up to. So no, that clearly was a massive help and a massive reassurance to me, as were so many other stories of people that have got nothing to do with elite sport and who aren't household names. So yeah, Nigel certainly helped, but there was probably endless other people out there that I would watch in their YouTube blogs of them just living life and looking at it and ultimately wanting to be able to share my life with someone, the highs, the lows, the successes, the failures. And the only way I was going to be able to do that is by being honest. And eventually the scales tip and yeah, the negatives outweigh, or the positives outweigh the negative for once, which is when you take that plunge and do come out eventually.
Yeah, and do you think your life changed when you did come out, Craig? Did you, again, we talked about weight being lifted off of the shoulders, and you said in the interview with Nick as well that you were kind of trying to think about what stories you told other people about who you were seeing and stuff. So did you kind of think, well, that's it now, this is me, I don't have any of those, you know, questions around or any of those stories that I have to think of?
I wouldn't say it changed massively, but the subtle things made a massive difference. As I say, like, you didn't have to worry about what your cover stories were. And I suppose I got so used to that, it became normal, but it was energy sapping, and it was time consuming when you're heading to like a training session at Twickenham or to meet your mates. You like got to think about, hang on, what do we talk about last time? What's this girl's name again that I talked about last time? And it becomes energy consuming. So the fact that you could just go about living life in a sort of an unforced, unedited fashion, yeah, was liberating. And I suppose it's more noticeable to people around me than it was to me, sort of the extra spring in your step, the extra smile on your face, the extra bit of energy that I apparently had to bring to whatever I was throwing myself at in life. I mean, I wouldn't describe my days in the closet as unhappy, as a lot of people are. So you could say I was quite lucky in that sense. But yeah, it's only with hindsight when you look back that you realised it could have been sort of better than it was.
Yeah, but Rob touched on kind of Levi Davis, who's obviously with Ealing now, who did a great interview with BT Sport, Hugo and Monty talking about his sexuality as well. And we are seeing more people, Craig, talking more about their own sexuality. I mean, there's a brilliant interview on Sky Sports with Australian prop Dan Palmer, who talks about his story and sort of, unfortunately, the distress it caused him before he was able to talk to his agent about sort of how he was feeling and this is the life he wanted to lead. And I guess that highlights this is a great first step, and the steps are being taken for people to tackle that stigma around the LGBT community, Craig. But is there for you still work to be done? Because some of these stories that, especially Dan's, you can see how much distress it does cause him, and there is still work that needs to be done to tackle these stereotypes.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, work still to be done. I think you never want to become complacent. So even when you think it's in a good place, you want to try and make it better. And I think part of that pride game at Harlequins, that they did some research, didn't they? And the data that came out still showed a lot of sort of homophobic terminology being used, and it was being used not because people generally wanted to be homophobic, they just felt they had to use it to fit in. I think as many people using it also wanted it to stop, which I think if people then practice what they preached, it would go a long way to solving a lot of the problems that still exist. So yeah, clearly work still to be done, and I suppose people like Dan, like Nigel, potentially like me, the more we talk out about it, the more guys like yourselves and Stonewall and the run their campaigns, and the more you get those on the back of those campaigns, work being done in the community. I suppose it's slow work, but eventually it all starts to add up. And we talk about incremental gains in sport all the time. It's those incremental gains slowly accumulate, and then they become a whirlwind that self-sustain and can't be stopped. So yeah, I mean, yes, work to be done, and you need to keep the focus on it, the awareness on it, because otherwise people will forget about it or become complacent. So provided we keep doing that, though, I've no doubt it'll be an even better place than it already is. Because I don't think we can forget how far we have come in a relatively short space of time. Clearly a lot more to be done, but certainly a lot of progress has been made, which would be wrong to ignore.
And that Harlequins match you touched on there, Craig, I think that's a positive, isn't it? Because you look at it and you think our sport is continuing to learn. And I do think when you do look at some of the elite sports like football and rugby in particular, they do make a big effort to support the Rainbow Laces campaign, don't they?
No, 100%. And you'd like to think that support is quite easy for them to give. Certainly is in rugby. If people are playing rugby, if most people would have come up through the grassroots where the values of the game are alive and strong and kicking. So they've come through that grassroots, that community level rugby. I think a lot of elite players are still quite connected to those community clubs as well. So they appreciate what the game is about, what it stands for. So throwing their support behind that campaign, it's great to see them do it, and long may it continue.
Yeah, and you mentioned kind of hopefully people do listen to this podcast and do listen to your story, and as you say, the catalyst for them to maybe come out and chat to someone about this sort of thing, Craig. So for anyone who is listening, is there any advice you'd give to any LGBT plus people who are starting out in rugby or the sporting world or in society in general to maybe have that conversation and start that catalyst?
I'm always cautious about giving advice because people's situation is so unique, and unless you've walked in their shoes, it's pretty hard to fully understand it. But from my perspective, I'd say I want to do what I enjoy. So I would, if there's any obstacles in your way that stop you doing what you're going to do because you enjoy it, then you need to do what you can to remove those obstacles, because you want to enjoy what you do in life, because that's going to put a smile on your face and make you happy. And if it's worries about how people will perceive you, then I think, as I learned, you need to give people a chance, because 99% of the people I told didn't have an issue with it. And even the people I thought would have a massive issue with it didn't. So you can't just see the worst in people. So give them a chance, be honest about what you want to talk about with them, and A, you'll be happier for it. And those obstacles to you doing what you want to do will be removed if they're obstacles there in the first place. And you may be actually pleasantly surprised with how engaging and supportive people can be. And sometimes the people you think the least will be supportive can be the most supportive people there. But you'll never know unless you have that conversation and give them a chance and stop seeing the worst in everyone.
Yeah, very, very well put, Craig. Very well put. And I guess as well, sort of that enjoyment and giving people a chance is definitely something that's relatable in rugby very much so at the moment. I mean, we saw over the last week or so the hashtag I Care campaign, which has come out following the postponement of the Six Nations, and some of the ridiculous comments that people have posted about the women's game. And I guess someone who has been taking their chance as well and sort of tackling those stigmas and those stereotypes has been one of your colleagues, Sarah Cox, over the last few months or so. So is it great also to see that part of rugby evolving as well as the conversations that people are having?
Yeah, I think it's great. It's a joy to work with Sarah. Great to have her on board. And likewise, I think she'd say the same. Like what she does, she does it because she enjoys it, and she's doing it because that's her. That's what she's about. And the positive effects that come on the back of it clearly are fantastic. I think me and Coxie, it's great that, again, it's a testament to the RFU that we're both there doing the jobs we do as professional referees, because we're good at what we do, and there's no obstacles that Twickenham's put in our way to be able to do that. And that's how it should be.
Hi guys, I'm Amber Reid and I'm a Loose Heads ambassador, and you're listening to the Loose Heads podcast. Remember that mental health is a journey, not a destination.
And just in terms of your referee journey, if you don't mind now, and I know sort of we touched on your local club before, Lichfield, but did becoming an official, was that on your mind when you started playing rugby, or did you want to pursue a career in rugby and see where it went when you were younger?
Being an official certainly wasn't anything that I had on my radar or anyone around me thought I'd be. I was quite a reserved, quiet, shy kid. So the fact that you can then be, in theory, in control of 30 players on a pitch was, a very strange concept. From getting injured and then ending up as a spectator watching my side play, made it very apparent to me that I was a rubbish spectator. The game values are heavily challenged when I find myself on the side of a rugby pitch, because I can be the worst for shouting stuff on, which is probably not the best thing. But that got me into refereeing. I had to do something and I couldn't play. And then I suppose it's just pure circumstance that the business manager at my secondary school ran the local ref society. So he was really persuasive in getting me to continue refereeing and not going back to playing. And thankfully I listened to him, and he thankfully put the effort in to get me to do it, because it yeah, I didn't look back from that point onwards. And I enjoyed refereeing a lot more than playing. I think purely because at that point I was going into the Colts age group, whereas an under 17 Colt, you're not really going to get much game time because you're the youngest age grade there. So refereeing was something where I got to do it a lot more than playing at that point in my life. And yeah, that's probably where the enjoyment factor came from.
It's interesting you said there about being a vocal supporter. I remember listening to the Peter Crouch podcast when they had Mike Dean on, and he goes down to the Tranmere games.
Tranmere, yeah.
And he finds himself now and again just going, oh, come on, ref. Come on, ref. And obviously that's weird for him to say. Do you ever, when you're watching a game, do you ever find yourself doing the same?
100%. We're the worst for it. A, it's really hard to watch a game of rugby and not focus on what the referee's doing. But yeah, we're the worst for it when it comes to not criticising, but just passing comments. Yeah, it's a lot easier being in an armchair than it is out in the middle. But yeah, we're not immune to it. We will still quite happily sit there and shout. But I suppose that's just because you're passionate, and we appreciate when you're passionate about something. You'd expect people to have an opinion on it and want to shout about it. But that equally means that when you're on the receiving end of it, you've got to take it in a constructive, positive fashion as well.
Have there been any comments that have been shouted out to you that you particularly remember over the years?
That's the joy of doing... Well, that's the joy of doing it when there's crowds normally, is that you don't actually hear it, because when 30,000 people are just shouting whatever at you, it all becomes just a blur, which is fantastic. You can't really hear anything. I think the only noticeable comment came, as you probably suspect, from Welford Road, when it went deadly silent. The number four, who at the time was an ex-pro ref, Andrew Small, ran some water onto me, and all you heard out of the crowd was, "Smallie, he doesn't need water, he needs some bloody advice." Which brought a smile to my face and sent a chuckle cascading down the Crumbly stand. But apart from that comment, no, we're quite lucky in the sense that, I mean, unlike the grassroots where, because there's only 20, 30 people watching, you can normally hear everything. In a full stadium, it just becomes a blur most of the time.
I was going to say, Craig, you mentioned there that you do pass comment a lot when you are watching games. And am I right in saying, were you a scrum half when you were younger? Or is that something I've misread?
No, ended up at scrum half. So I think started at fly half, progressed to the centre, and then ended up at scrum half. So did a nice little trip around the back line. And yeah, poacher turned gamekeeper, because I think probably, as Carl would have said, you're one of the most vocal players on the pitch, an opinion on most things, to the referee, to your own players, to the opposition. And yeah, once you've got that whistle in your hand, it's amazing how different you want those conversations and interactions with the scrum half to go.
You don't sympathise with them at all. Now, Craig, you're there. You know, no, I'm not going to go back to that past life of being a scrum half who was chatting back to a referee. I'm not going to sympathise with them at all.
I sympathise them in some circumstances. It depends how they go about making their point. If they're making it in a pretty reasonable way, then I'll quite happily be like, "You probably got a point there, and I got it wrong." But if they're just screaming and shouting and just being very unhelpful in that fashion, then it's going to be a short shift response from me. But thankfully, once you tap most of them on the shoulder and you're like, "Look, I want to work with you, but we can't work like this," most of them will adapt pretty quickly, and we can have some pretty good working relationships, which helps everyone. The better the lines of communication, they know what I want from them, they know what they can and can't do, and that normally just allows some rugby to happen, where everyone gets on with their job and leads each other to it, which is always ideal.
How do you think, Craig, you would get on? It's a really unfair question. How do you think you'd get on switching to football? Because when I, the reason I ask this, when I watch you referee specifically, you have incredible restraint. So there's cheating going on at every line out, every scrum, every everything, and you take it very objectively. And when there's a decision to be made, you say it very clearly and move on. And there's no theatrics. But at football, you've got it's overt cheating. There's people falling over for no reason. The kid in the ref, and at some point, I guess rugby values come into it, where you could say to a rugby player, "I know exactly what you're doing, stop it, or else you'll be spending 10 minutes somewhere else. And that'll be the end of it." Whereas at football, it just seems that's an accepted part of the game. How do you think you get on as a football ref?
It's a great question. And it's almost something where I think a few of us would love to just have one game to see how it went.
To change the whole world.
it potentially could be revolutionary. But I just think, you'd have to go pretty, you'd basically just have grabbed the ball by the horns and deal with it. So you'd go in with a pretty fair approach, but the second what normally happens as you describe it, then you just referee it as you see it. And the challenge would actually be not backing off, because you'd probably find a lot of free kicks, a lot of yellow cards, potentially then you'll get into double yellows and reds very early if we referee the rugby values in a football context. So yeah, the challenge would actually be not backing off and being true to what you're trying to do, which is I'm prepared to talk to you and work with you, but if you're just going to scream, shout and roll around on the floor, we're not going to get on and the sanctions are going to keep coming. But it's a nice hypothetical question. If that was the approach, how quickly would things change?
And there was a couple of instances last night. I just happened to watch a little bit of the game, the Manchester City Aston Villa game, but irrelevant.
Yep.
But they had the obvious thing, which I just think if a rugby referee was refereeing this game, you're right, you'd be double yellow cards and red cards within 10 minutes. You'd be playing six against six eventually. But it was when somebody takes a free kick and the opposition just stand in front of the free kick, delaying it being taken, which clearly we're blessed by having laws and they have rules. And I'm not drawing a distinction between rugby and football, but that's got to be, you cannot delay a free kick. You surely cannot. So how do they ever get away with it? And I reckon a rugby ref would just say, you do that again, you're off, and tell your mates because you're off.
Yeah, I think we're blessed with the fact that yellow card means 10 minutes, which is a bit more of a deterrent. I think, to be fair, there's probably some football refs that would just give them a yellow card there and there, nice and early on, sets a nice clear stall out. And then it's amazing what that would probably solve for the rest of the game.
Yeah,
we fall foul of it in rugby as well. If for the first 10 minutes, if we don't set the game up in a structured sort of way where everyone knows what the parameters are, then it just causes chaos for the next 70 minutes because people think they can get away with stuff all over the place. If we set that game up, I don't mean by set the game up, we blow the whistle constantly. It can as much be talking to players behind the scenes as it is blowing the whistle. But if we get that game set up, those relationships established, it normally helps the game for the rest of it. So if someone does go and stand in front of a free kick 2 minutes in, you're like, right, we're not having that today. People want to play rugby. People want to see stuff happen. You'll just kind of kill it. That's it. And then hopefully that sort of nullifies anything like that in the bud and we get on with the game. If you do nothing about it, then you're probably going to incentivize chaos.
I'd love to drop Mike Dean into the middle of a packed Welford Road or a packed fan zone to see how he would get on officiating a rugby game. That would be high quality 80 minutes of entertainment, I think.
100%. It'd be a great idea for an exchange programme, isn't it?
The other intolerable thing about what I see at football, and I'm not having a go, I think football's, it's a great game. I love playing five-a-side. It's a great game. And however, when you get the players visibly, we can't hear them, but maybe with less crowds we can. But we can lip read, and they're clearly swearing at a referee as they walk away, having been reprimanded for something that was their fault, and that's just condoned. It's just that would never happen on a rugby field, not a rugby field I've ever played on.
We did a lot of work with them when VAR first came in, and I think one of our biggest points we made to them was like the power of being able to be heard and explain your decision. And they don't have that. So there's a lot of these VAR. I think the one last night may be a prime example. If the VAR and the referee had that opportunity live to say, look, this is the law. You may not like it. You may not agree with it. But this is what we've got to referee. It probably would have nullified a lot of those complaints there and then. Or at least people would be complaining about the law and not directing it at the individual making an honest decision. So the power of being able to articulate why you're doing what you're doing, people will still disagree with you, but at least they know specifically what they're disagreeing with. I think we'd love, even if they only open it up for VAR decisions. I think they do it like the NFL, they hit the button to explain those big decisions to the whole stadium, even if it's something like that. But yeah, it's a good point. They need to be able to be heard in certain situations, I think.
I think that's so important as well in rugby for growing the game, because if people are tuning in, you know, people have got a lot more time to tune in and because they're at home at the moment, but tune into BT Sport and they get the laws spoken to them and you're explaining the game to them as it's going on, then people are going to learn the game quicker as well. And more people will be persuaded to watch rugby and enjoy it more and understand it.
Yeah, no, spot on. And I think we're quite lucky with BT that we do a lot of a lot of work with a commentary team there, and I think we've got a call in the diary with them next week, just where we go through the topics that we've got on our agenda and issues that they raise, which allows us to work pretty collaboratively together. But that then means that they're able to better explain why we're doing what we're doing, or they know when to be quiet, listen to our on-field explanation, which they then can back up. As you say, it benefits and helps everyone. It helps us, as you say, it helps all those new supporters watching, or those grassroots players that want a better grasp of the nuances of, I don't know what, the breakdown, which can be quite grey at times.
Just to kind of take us into the mindset of a referee and some of those sort of greyer areas around rugby, what's going through your mind as a referee when you've just watched a scrum collapse for the third time with no clear infringements going on and 2-3 minutes has kind of come off the clock?
Well, you know what TV are we talking about at that point, and it's not normally not positive. It probably links to a law change that the game needs to bring in my view, when it comes to scrums. I think we're in the mantra now as officials where we need to make decisions. And normally we reset a scrum, as you say, once, then we find ourselves there 3 sets later when actually, if we'd have backed our gut instinct, we could have made the decision at the first time of asking. But there is, you end up between a rock and a hard place. People want you to make accurate decisions, but by the time you get to the third scrum, people just want you to make a decision. So we're not stuck at scrums. I think we're doing a lot of work as a group to allow us at the first time of asking to make a decision, or to find the individual who is at fault and put masses of pressure on them to do better. But it all comes down to the mindset of the players and the mindset of the teams. If you've got two positive scrummaging teams, so take the last game I did, Newcastle-Gloucester, two positive teams in that game at scrummage. Scrum didn't present a challenge. It wasn't a blight on the game. It was a good feature of the game to restart, but not one that I had to get involved with. So it's as much a referee responsibility as it is a player responsibility. You get two sets of players that want to scrum for penalties or really go into the deep, dark arch, then they bring us into the equation and you end up with probably not the best spectacle. So it's a joint responsibility to get that right. And when it comes to us, when you're 3 scrums in, you're in a whole world of pain, and the decision you give on the third scrum probably isn't as good as the decision you should have given at the first scrum.
Dare I ask what that law change you think should be is?
So people won't like me saying this, but I think the reality is the game is in the entertainment business. It's got to entertain people. It's got to attract new people to seats and stadiums and to pay their subscription to watch on TV. And the reality is the modern breed of fans does not understand the traditions and intricacies of where the scrum has come from. So as far as I'm concerned, give each scrum a single chance to work. If it doesn't work after one set, give the team putting the ball in a free kick, unless it's an attacking 5-meter scrum, in which case leave them to try and win that penalty try. That's trying to strike a balance between keeping the scrum a contested part of the game, but also acknowledging we can't be there 2 minutes later messing around still, because that's not entertainment and that's not what people want to watch. At least it's not what the majority of the new breed of supporters in the game want to watch.
I like that. I think it makes a lot of sense. Like you say, rugby ultimately, as much as it's a game, it is entertainment at the top level, and it feels like there's an awful lot of wasted time that's probably turning off fans who are on the cusp of maybe following rugby closely. But things like the scrum, the amount of time taken, with penalty kicks and things like that, what, ball in play time, 42, 43 minutes a game.
So if you're lucky.
maybe I'm being a bit optimistic, but little tweaks like that could make a huge difference and hopefully help rugby appeal to a much wider global audience.
Well, at least the threat of that law change coming in may force a few more teams to be a bit more positive in their approach, so we don't have to go down that route. You look at how many variations and law changes are brought in. It's not beyond the realms of possibility for it to be considered, I suppose. But then you have to look at the law of unintended consequences. You can bring that law change in and it could cause a load of other unforeseen potential problems in the game. But it'd be nice to see it trialled somewhere at least.
And speaking of entertainment, Caterpillar looks, Nesh needs to go. I've seen a few of your colleagues, I think Luke Pearce, a couple of months ago maybe, Craig decided to blow up and penalise a scrum half for literally not getting rid of the ball quick enough. Is that one of those things you talked about before, about, you know, 30% of the law book is what you referee and you make your stamps early on in the game?
Yeah, so that's where the law potentially isn't our friend, because, like, we can't tell teams to use it unless the ball is available. And then once we say use it, they have 5 seconds. And that 5 seconds is a lot longer than the players like to think it is when they try and help us by counting down from five on the field. So yeah, if that's where we may want to speed the game up, but we can't necessarily go outside of law to achieve that, because law is ultimately our safety net when teams are questioning why have you turned the ball over at this ruck. Especially when we then go back to what we just talked about, if we turn that ball over for them taking too long to box kick and then get stuck at a scrum for 2 minutes, no one's going to be thanking us. Everyone would have preferred to wait the extra 2 seconds for the box kick to go and us maybe tap the nine on the shoulder and go, look, let's speed that up, than us be at a scrum for 2 minutes. So again, yeah, you've got to think of the consequence of us turning it over, but we're certainly looking to speed them up. Could you change the law to allow that to happen? You potentially could. You could ditch it from 5 seconds and make it an even smaller amount of time. We could be a lot more savvy. As in, if we start seeing people being called in to build this caterpillar ruck, we could then be given the license just to say use it at that instance. There's lots of chats going on about speeding the game up. I think there's a working group being pulled together at the moment to look at a whole host of ideas to try and make the game faster and more entertaining, which is only a good thing. I mean, one of the ideas is putting a clock on kicks, so conversions and penalties, having a clock on them, I think like they're doing in the top 14, just so they don't take more time than they're meant to, which on the face of it seems like a good idea. But if you look behind it, a potential unintended consequence, that could actually mean more time is spent on the kicks. The second the kicker knows how long he's got in front of him, he's more inclined to use the entire allocated slot of time. So instead of one kick taking, I don't know, 65 seconds and the rest being about 30, 40, all the kicks now become 60 seconds because he wants to use his time on all the kicks. Now you've actually lost more time than you've saved. So you've got to think about the potential consequences of that.
I've got a list of probably... I love rugby. Rugby's brilliant. If God hadn't invented it, we'd have to invent it for her or him or whomever God might be. But when a try is scored over the line, they stand up and then you can't see the try scorer because his fellow subs have swamped him. So Johnny May's try, you know, where he unbelievable speed, probably didn't kick it in the right place, but scored the try, and then he couldn't see Johnny May for everybody jumping on top of him. That surely they're not allowed on the pitch.
It's interesting. At the moment, that's no longer a problem we face because they've banned celebrations and they've now got players warming up at the opposite end of the pitch, precisely because they're not allowed to celebrate. But who knows? That may be even post-COVID, if we can look that far ahead, that may be something that stays.
Yeah.
So by having replacements at the opposite end of the pitch, you remove the fact they can't then charge onto the pitch and celebrate, or even run onto the pitch and just provoke the defenders who have just conceded a try. I mean, it's a highly emotional situation. It probably makes sense to have them at the opposite end of the pitch.
Yeah.
Players get to be a lot more creative about how they celebrate socially distanced. So I suppose it's a different way for them to spend some time in training, I suppose, coming up with those ideas. So we'll see what we get when we get some rugby back.
I'll leave my other 23 things for another day. Sorry.
That's a separate podcast in itself, I think, Mark. I know we're talking a lot there about the changes in the game and what we've changed, what laws we've changed, Craig. But one nice thing that I saw when you talked about sort of your refereeing journey is you're doing your hobby as a job, aren't you? You know, you every single day you're waking up, you're going to work and building towards that weekend game on a Saturday. So that enjoyment factor must be there for you every single time you take to the field.
Yeah, it's a strange one. It's a good question because when it is your hobby, it's very different to when it's your job. Because normally, obviously, when I was working in pharma, you're constantly trying to fight time to go and referee. Whereas now it's a case of you're fighting to get away from refereeing to do something else just so you can come at it fresh and recharged. And yeah, as for the enjoyment factor, clearly if I didn't enjoy it, I wouldn't be doing it. But I'd be lying if I said you enjoyed every 80 minutes in the middle or you enjoyed the package and baggage that goes with every single game, because that wouldn't be true. But yeah, the net effect is clearly, yeah, you have to enjoy what you're doing. And I suppose that enjoyment for me is, I think I alluded to it earlier, is that weekly challenge. And you've no idea what that challenge is going to be until you're there in the middle. And then you've got to adapt and survive and see whether the skill set you have is meeting those challenges. And if it's not, then you damn well want to be better the week after.
Yeah, and it seems as well, Craig, that referee environment seems like a really good place to be. I mean, Carl Dixon on the podcast talks about how you all get on, and sometimes you have your social nights out, and he talks about Wayne Barnes not handling his drink and stuff like that. But in terms of sort of that environment, is it a great place to, you know, when you meet up at Twickenham and you do your training and stuff like that? It just seems like a really good environment to be a part of.
No, it's a really close-knit group of lads and girls. And I suppose that's because we go into some pretty high-pressure situations where, and we spend weekends away together normally, that, yeah, you get to know each other, not just from a professional level, but from a personal perspective as well in each other's families. And so, yeah, it is a close-knit team, and that probably helps us, because that means, like, going back to having a conversation, there's probably not many things we can't talk about, whether it's work-related, family-related, whatever, as a team. And it means we're prepared to challenge each other, so the so-called courageous conversation. So whether it's your newest ref in like Sarah or Christoph or your most established guys like Wayne, no one's beyond being challenged and having a discussion and a conversation over whatever the decision is or whatever a particular philosophy, TMO philosophy that we're talking about. That's probably where we're struggling at the moment. It's like a lot of those conversations happen in the gym or when you're walking between meeting rooms. They're not set agenda items. They're not scripted meetings, they're just off the cuff remarks talking about rugby and decisions where you can learn so much from each other. So that's our biggest challenge, obviously being remote at the moment, is that. But yeah, certainly a fun and close-knit place to be.
Even during those touch rugby games, do they ever get competitive?
They get highly competitive. And what I've learned is that the only time I play well is when TV cameras are involved.
Nice.
So when Nick did the interview with me and we had cameras in, and when BT did a piece on us a few seasons ago, I think that's the only time that the so-called young team has ever won any game of touch rugby that we played. We just turn it on when it matters, it appears.
Who's part of the young team? I'm interested now, Craig.
But it has changed a lot. I think I'm still hanging on by about a year. And then the new sort of whistle snappers following us through are taking that mantle. But the problem is they're actually quite good. So the second I'm off the team, they'll start winning frequently and I'll be on the old team that's losing all the time.
Brilliant, brilliant. And quick, just to maybe before we go on to the final part of the podcast, Craig, I just wanted to fire a few questions at you that we fired to Carl, and he was kind of a little bit on the fence about it in terms of sort of some of the players he's refereed and sort of the matches he's officiated. But I was going to ask sort of in terms of players you've dealt with, captains you refereed, is there anyone that stands out for you during the game?
I don't think there's one captain. I think there's a style of captaincy. So I'm a fan of leading by example. So actions speak louder than words. So sort of any captain or any player who fits that mould, then yeah, it's probably definitely enjoy that style a lot more. But captains or players that instead of shouting at you or just trying to dispute a decision, they just generally want to ask a question, have a conversation and understand what you want. And then equally that works in reverse. I'm then a lot more prepared to listen to their questions and give them an answer. So it's a two-way process. And once you strike up that rapport of being able to talk to each other, listen to the answer, and then not dispute that answer, but then go and apply that, whether they agree with the answer or not, that's when you get the best and most fruitful relationships. If it's just a case of asking a question, getting the answer, not liking the answer and challenging it, disputing it and arguing it, that's never going to be a fruitful relationship, because I'm not about to change 20 minutes into a game how something's being refereed. So then it's down to them to adapt. And I know Richie McCall gets a lot of criticism, but his view was very much, if I give away two penalties for the same offence, then I failed as a player and as a captain because I've not adapted to what the referee wants. And the reality is that's part of the skill of being an elite referee and an elite player, is you've got to adapt. They've got to adapt to what I want as a referee, but equally, no game's the same. I've got to adapt to what they're doing. So as I said, that Newcastle-Gloucester game, two really positive front rows, I had very little to do. My next game may not be the same with new players, new teams, so I then have to adapt. So it's the same with the captains, having to adapt to where we are on a week-by-week basis. And provided we've communicated that clearly, then there's no reason why they shouldn't be able to adapt and just have a decent working relationship for that game.
Very diplomatic answer there, Craig.
Can't go naming too many people. Still got to work with them.
Very, very true. Very, very true. And maybe in terms of sort of the games or some of the standout moments you've been on the field for, is there anything where you've just maybe taken a step back and gone, blimey, how was that player done that, or what a try that was, or brilliant tackle, brilliant interception, that kind of thing?
Oh, geez, there's probably, in terms of moments, yeah, there's probably so many, but in terms of specific games that stand out, yeah. I mean, doing the Army-Navy was a fantastic occasion purely because you had 82,000 people singing the national anthem. That has to stand out as a moment. I think doing Munster against the New Zealand Maori, so when they have sold out Bowman Park singing Fields of Athenry, that almost, I forgot I was meant to be refereeing. You just want to stop, stand and listen and take it all in. That's a truly iconic moment. I think, and then it'd be wrong not to mention the Premiership final. I don't think you can referee the biggest domestic game and not appreciate certain periods of that game. I think particularly to the last couple of minutes when you're almost, I was going to say home and dry, but we certainly weren't dry. But you know the feeling of we're about to see this game through without there being any mass controversy, which is always a success. So I suppose it's probably those moments, but you probably don't fully appreciate them until well after the event. Because I used to watch post-match interviews growing up and wondered why everyone kept talking about, particularly big finals, relief was always a word that came off their lips, relief that it's over and it's done. And I can fully appreciate why everyone is relieved to get off the pitch and have the game over with, especially from our perspective as a referee.
So I was going to touch on the Premiership final, Craig. Obviously, a special occasion for you, but I can get a sense of the build-up wasn't the same because I think Wayne was supposed to do it, wasn't he? And then, obviously, you get told about... When were you told about doing the Premiership final? And was it kind of a moment, well, yeah, right, I'm going to do this now. And then that sort of... Maybe you were going back to those interviews you've seen of officials saying it was a bit of a relief after a final. Were those thoughts then starting to emerge?
So... Wayne's positive test was on the Monday. I was told on the Tuesday I'd be doing it, but it wasn't announced until Friday. So the week itself was pretty standard in the sense that the only people knew was the refereeing group that appointment had changed. So the preparation-wise actually was surprisingly normal. And it wasn't until my phone went into meltdown on the Friday morning when you realise, well, this isn't just a normal game because I don't receive hundreds of messages for normal games of rugby, that's when you start to realise that, Jesus Christ, there'll be a lot of people watching this, both here and globally. And yeah, that's where the relief comes in. You get off the pitch and it's like, right, we haven't got anything going viral on Twitter for the wrong reasons. That must be a success.
Yeah, you talk about the relief there, Craig, but I guess as you, as a successful referee as you are, you want to take the next step, do more finals, do big games. Is that the ambition? I mean, we're seeing so many of these Premiership referees now getting opportunities in Europe and on the international stages. Is that a goal? Is that final giving you a taste for that, maybe?
I think it's a goal for everyone, isn't it? I think you want to apply your skill set at the highest possible level, whatever level that may be. And like some of my refereeing colleagues at the community level, their skill set may take them up to level 6, level 5, and for them that's where their ceiling is, but it's still a great achievement and they still get to apply it at a great level. So yeah, wherever it takes it for me, it will take it. But I suppose it's the same analogy with sand in your hand, isn't it? The harder you clutch at it, the more it's going to slip through your hand. So I think you still got to enjoy what you're doing in the here and now and be true to yourself, and then whatever comes off the back of that, if it's games at a higher level, then that's fantastic. But I mean, even if they don't come, I think you still got to pinch yourself to recognise that there's only 9 of us in the country doing what we do. And it's something I certainly never set out to do. I never set out to have a hobby as a job. And yeah, you can't forget how lucky you are to be able to do that.
Hi, guys. I'm Sam James. I'm a Looseheads ambassador. And you're listening to the Looseheads podcast. Make your mental health a priority.
And speaking of big games, I use this segue far too much to lead into the final part of the podcast, but it's now time for our Mars 15, and Lee Masopawanga we had on last week, Craig, he really enjoyed this. He even tweeted about it last night when the podcast was published about hopefully his Mars 15 can rule the world, as he put it, I think. So normally for this part of the podcast, I'll pass over to Mark. So Mark, over to you for this.
This is going to be fascinating because the precept is this. The Martians have landed. They have no idea of coronavirus. They don't know the world is in a bit of strife, but they quite fancy living on Earth. And they have challenged the Earth to a game of rugby to decide the future of civilization, amongst a few other trivial things. We've conducted the toss. We've lost the toss, so we're playing away. So on Saturday, a shuttle leaves on which there will be a 15 and a backroom staff. And I think we should add in a referee for this particular one as well.
I was going to point out there was no referee to be selected. So
yeah. we're going to throw that in at the last minute. It's a game we have to win. So it's, and it, therefore, because it's completely bonkers, the rules are completely bonkers also, in that it's any gender, any era, any player, to win the game, and it has to be won. So, Craig Maxwell-Keys, over to you.
Could possibly go wrong, a referee selecting people that for a must-win game. Always going to be successful, isn't it? So in terms of backroom staff, I'll start with that. So coach-wise, I went for Bill Walsh, so the San Francisco 49ers coach of some years back, purely because I loved the philosophy that he brought as a coach. Completely turned the San Francisco 49ers around. He basically, whether it was the cleaners in the stadium to your multi-million pound quarterback, everybody understood the role that they had to play. So I think that would be integral. Manager-wise, I was going to bring along, there you go, great book, 100%. Manager-wise, Bear Grylls. So survival expert seems quite logical if we're going to go to Mars. Military background, logistics, organisation, he's got that covered. And you can't go a Bear Grylls show without him talking about positivity. So that's not a bad vibe to have about a squad. Kitman and Waterboy, I went closer to home from a refereeing perspective. So Christoph Ridley, fellow referee, likes to think he knows a lot about fashion. So he's in charge of kit on that basis. See what disaster he comes up with there. The kit probably won't make the shuttle knowing his organisation skills, but there we go. Waterboy, I've put my boss there, Spreaders, purely because he'll hate being the water boy. So that's part of the reason for putting him there. But anyone that knows Spreaders, great laugh, always down for a joke. So long old trip, he'll be at the heart of the entertainment, I'm sure. As for the on-field 15, where it probably matters, this is where it goes all wrong. Front row, so we went for Jason Leonard and Adam Jones as props, two big physical presences up front. I put Josh Hodgson, actually, the NRL hooker, in at two, purely because he's a fantastic ball poacher and we need the ball if we're going to score tries. And my style of rugby, I'd much prefer refereeing games where you've got tries after try and defence is optional. So that's the approach we're going for. Second row, in the row, again, physical presence, try and get that domination. Victor Matfield and Eden Insabet, two really big characters. Back row, and this is where the only current player I think actually still is, to be fair, definitely from England. So Richie McCall, just for his leadership skills and his ability to work with match officials, is second to none. Tom Curry, just because we need a devil at the breakdown. And then Sergio Parise. Hopefully we don't forget the importance of the game, but if we do, he'll certainly bring the passion factor. So that's why he's there. But nine and 10, I mean, probably because I love watching both of them when I was growing up. So Rob Burrow is going in at nine, just because just often completely underestimated, but a fantastically skillful player. So I dare say the Martians will underestimate him at their peril. And Johnny Wilkinson, just because he was an all-time hero of mine growing up. And again, fits what I mentioned earlier, led by example, not by shouting loads of fancy words around. Wingers, hopefully try machines, and to be fair, fullback as well. So gone Jason Robinson on one wing, Martin O'Fire on the other wing, and then Christian Cullen at fullback. I don't think there's been a more prolific international try scorer from fullback than him. And then finally in the centre, I went for a well-established centre partnership. I think centres have got to understand each other inside out to bring the best out of each other. So who better than Gordon Darcy and Brian O'Driscoll to finish that lineup? So hopefully we haven't just condemned ourselves to defeat, but we'll give it a shot with that squad.
So finally, probably two questions. A, who would be the referee and why? But secondly, just to really put you on the spot, who out of your 15 would be the first person to get a yellow card?
I think I'd send Wayne to referee it, to be fair, purely because then the rest of us may get a look in to do some games. So from a purely selfish perspective, I'd stick Wayne on the shuttle. who would get the first yellow card in there? Knowing Wayne on a trip with the alcoholic drink on the shutter, they'd probably yellow card himself so he'd go back to the bar. there we go.
Absolutely brilliant.
Now we've got confirmation here from Craig and Carl Dixon that Wayne Barnes likes a drink. Maybe Wayne's another guest we need to get on the podcast, guys. I'm sure he can tell the stories. I don't think it's Craig or Carl's place to tell the stories, unless you want to share anything, Craig, with us now.
You could ask him the stories. Whether he recalls many of them would be a different story.
Brilliant team, and a very well-balanced team, actually, Craig. I'm sure they'll do a good job on Mars. Well, Craig, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the podcast today. Thank you for talking to us about your refereeing career, but obviously about the Rainbow Laces campaign and the Stonewall stuff as well. Diversity, inclusivity, tackling stigmas is everything that Loosehead stands for, and it's been really good to get you on that as well today, Craig. So thank you so much for joining us.
No, brilliant. Thank you for having me on. No, I appreciate it.
And as always, many thanks to Rob, Mark and Dave for the time.
Thank you, Chris.
And that has been another episode of the Looseheads Podcast in association with Talking Rugby Union. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to the Looseheads Podcast. Join the movement.
Let's get people talking about mental health.
And together we will tackle the stigma. This is the Looseheads Podcast.